I'd like to welcome in the wonderful Katie Pierrez, who is a patient living with rheumatoid arthritis, a parent, talks a lot about parenthood and exercise with RA, volunteer with NRAS. Have I missed anything, Katie? You wear a lot of hats.
I don't think you've missed anything, and I can hear my little one knocking on the door. So
great.
We may get an impromptu other guest.
Not a problem. And if at any point you have to go, then of course I'm pleased to say it's not a problem. I know what it's like. I started one of these the other week where Dylan was having a full-blown tantrum outside my door, which was a little bit off putting. Yeah. But welcome in. How are you?
No, I'm good, thank you. How are you? Because obviously you've had
a lot going on. A lot going on, and it's felt like a series of chapters. As soon as I sort of address one issue, another issue pops up. But you know what that balance and act can be like. Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us on a Thursday. I really do appreciate it. Because I feel like you're one of the people we had on the show that I feel like I know personally the most, but I don't think we've ever actually had a one-on-one conversation, which feels weird after the last few years, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, and that's the beauty of social media. And all the different platforms that we can now engage with people on.
Yeah. So for anyone that doesn't know you as well as I feel like I do, do you want to just give a little introduction about yourself and then we'll get into your sort of diagnosis journey?
Yeah. So I'm Katie. I've suffered with rheumatoid arthritis for just about 12 years. Yeah. So it's 2011. So I was 28 when I was diagnosed. I'm a mother, work full time, and try as much as possible to participate in sort of exercise and sort of sports. So I run. I've recently completed the Brighton Marathon. I'll say completed, not raced. I regularly play netball and sort of try to keep as fit as possible to kind of, you know, help the overall health.
Now that gives me a lot of hope, and you don't take anything away from that achievement to do the marathon, because as somebody that used to enjoy running a lot, and I'm now sort of like in that horrible place where I feel like that might be gone for good, I'm going to be very much listening intently to what you have to say in the hope that I can try and recapture that. So good on you for that. So you mentioned your RA diagnosis. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? Like maybe how it onset, or what was that path? We get a very familiar theme on here about that, the length of time between onset and diagnosis. Was that a familiar story for you?
It is. So it didn't take me as long as many people I've heard. But I'd say my onset was quite sort of gradual. So I don't think I sort of realised how bad things were getting. It started in my feet and hands, so quite classic RA symptoms, but it was just, I was kind of just stiff and suffered with pain just in the morning. So generally by sort of 11 a.m. I was generally sort of fine, which I know is a word we don't like using too much, but and what I found was I was really struggling. So I was sort of working, I'd actually just moved in with my partner at the time, he's now my husband. And so it was quite embarrassing, because in the mornings I was like a 90 year old trying to sort of get ready, make a cup of tea. I live in South London, so I commute via sort of train to work. So getting, like, walking to the train station became problematic. But then every time I would book, say, a GP appointment, that would generally be after work. So I would then go to see my GP, but I couldn't really explain what the problem was, because it had gone by that point in the day. So I'd kind of, the way I try to explain it is I was like the Tin Man in the morning, but I was like a normal sort of 27 year old by the time I went to the GP surgery. So I just sounded like I was a hypochondriac. I went for multiple sort of blood tests. So they tested me for like low vitamin D, trigger finger, all sorts of things, but nobody kind of, really got to the bottom of it. And I was probably going on a 6 to 8 week sort of basis across a year. And I played a lot of tennis when I was younger, so I was still sort of playing socially at that time. And what hit me was the fact that I couldn't beat one of my friends I'd been able to beat at tennis for years. And my wrists were just so weak. it really hurt to hit a ball. And then I never got the classic big swollen joints, but one of my wrists sort of bruised and went brown and just looked a bit sort of manky, to be, you know, to be frank. Yeah. And then finally I found out that my grandma had had RA. That was news to me. And I went in, saw a GP, said, I think I've got RA. Can you do me a blood test? But it took about 12 months. And it was just a very horrible journey at that sort of age. I mean, I know a lot of people watching, these sort of diagnoses came much younger. But it was being able to, I found it really hard to kind of communicate my symptoms to get them to understand what was actually wrong with me.
Yeah, and you're not the first person to say that. It's amazing you went that long before they'd done some of them tests and everything. But I think there's a couple of bits that resonate there with me personally. Because when I was a kid, I kept getting asked, are you stiff in the morning? And I didn't have it then. But now, on my word, in my 30s, do I know why they were asking? Because I cannot get going until lunchtime. Yeah. In the afternoon, I'm fine. I can walk a dog really long time in the evening. But in the morning, it's horrible. And the same as that swelling. So, like, I don't have RA. I have a different form. But everybody looks for that swelling, and for those of us that don't have that, do you find there's like, you're like, I can't remember the word you use, but I felt like a fraud, you know? You'll go back and you can guarantee that one time you see the doctor, you have nothing to show for it, and it was almost like when I got psoriasis, it almost helped like confirm, like to show that I had something going on in the inside because of what was on the outside. So I could really relate to that. Do you find that had like an impact on your sort of like mentally on that front, because you sort of you're going backwards and forwards and didn't really have enough to show for how it was?
Well, you really impacted. Start questioning yourself, and you kind of think you're going, you know, there's something wrong with you mentally. But it's sort of family and friends that were useful, because my husband was sort of saying, no, you've got to go and get this sorted out. This isn't, you know, there's something wrong. And it was actually my sister that came to a couple of the sort of final sort of when I first went to the rheumatology department to kind of just help me to, because it's hard, I think, when it's going on with yourself and I'm sort of someone that will naturally just say, oh, no, there's nothing wrong, I'm okay. But it was really helpful for somebody else to kind of go along and sort of talk on my behalf in a way, to sort of explain exactly what they're seeing the differences are, because you sometimes as well, I don't think you realize it in yourself because it's so gradual. And I went on a big sort of thing that really flagged there was a definite problem. I went on a really brilliant holiday. One of my friends was getting married in Australia, so we went to Perth. But the heat, just that is when I did have swelling. I had sausage fingers for pretty much the whole time I was there. And I just, that holiday, it was meant to be like this really exciting time, and it was, but then it was also horrible at the same time. So it's got a funny memory in my mind.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's weird because you'll have then things that trigger. I know I do anyway. Like, you'll then associate like those sort of memories, don't you, with other things. So like for me, I've got a flare in my hip at the moment, so that harps back to my first ever flare in my hip. And I'm guessing, like with you and the heat thing, you hold on to that, don't you? And you associate it with it, and it affects your sort of planning and everything.
And it makes you a little bit fearful of sort of certain sort of situations, holidays. I love the sun, but I wouldn't really want to go anywhere super hot again, because I kind of know how, you know, that could affect me.
Yeah, and there is a big difference between sun and heat. Like, I always say to people, like, my arthritis, my skin, everything loves the sun, but that out and out heat causes its own issues, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you went through that period, and then how did that next stage look like for you in terms of finding what worked for it to get managed? Was there a bit of a gap between it getting managed or what you would consider managed? I know everyone's got a different view of what that controlled arthritis looks like, but is that still an ongoing process?
So I think it kind of got managed relatively quickly. But actually, when I look back and then realize how it was then managed maybe 5 years later, it maybe wasn't managed as well as I thought it was at the time. So I had the kind of stereotypical sort of methotrexate, hydroxychloroquine, sulfasalazine. And I'd say methotrexate worked quite quickly. So within 4 months, I did see quite a big improvement. And I was able to kind of start doing things again that I wanted to do. But then obviously there's also sort of the effects of having been kind of like inactive for a certain amount of time, yes, putting on weight, things like that, all kind of just builds kind of challenges, whether it's mentally, physically, everything like that. So I'd say sort of 4 months, it was relatively well managed, but there was still a lot of pain. There's a lot of things I still couldn't do. And probably within a year, I'd managed to get the sort of doses right of those three drugs that I was taking at that point.
And you made a really good point in there about like how it can feel like a mountain, because people focus on the pain or they focus on the treatment, but it's all the stuff, the baggage that comes with that. So like, as somebody that puts on a lot of weight when I flare, because I'm so used to being really sporty, it's really difficult then, isn't it? Because it's like, okay, the medicine might be working and your pain might be low, but you're still facing these massive barriers, whether that's like repairing social life or, yeah, getting fit again. Like, do you find that a challenge?
Yeah, because I think that impacts you just as much as the disease, because you kind of need to feel confident to then do certain things, I think. So it's this is something I've always had a slight issue with, is the fact that when you're diagnosed, and I get like there's time involved in those appointments, but everything's so focused on getting your disease score down, it's not always focused on what do you want. Like, there's no kind of goal setting. I know there's lots of talks about this in pathways and things that should be happening, but in the reality of it, it's not happening. And it always, you know, because I always have a bit of a, if I had those conversations earlier on, what could I be doing now?
And the thing is, just trying to get people to think, in my opinion, this, I'm not saying this is yours, but in my opinion as well, it's getting people to see that that's like reaping what you sow down the road as well. Because I always think, if I was more informed and involved and educated, and people ask me what I, you know, what a successful outcome was to me when I was younger, then I might not be such a problem now as an adult, because, you know, it's that managing expectations and learn how you can help yourself. And no one talked to me about triggers and, you know, and all they just kept saying is move more, take your painkillers, move more. And it's just like, it didn't tell me the why or what we were trying to achieve with all of that. And in an age where we're getting to see our doctors less and less, I'm really worried about what that looks like, because you and I had those experiences, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Whatever it must be like for new patients today. I try not to think about it too much, because I don't think I'd ever sleep, but yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's just sort of the whole access to physios, even. That, yeah, you kind of have to beg.
Yes. And now you've got these roles like well, you have, where I am anyway, where they'll have like a triage in your GP. It feels like you have to go through so many hoops to get to the specialist physiotherapy that used to be just like a given 10, 15 years, yeah, ago, didn't it? You know, you'd get your treatment plan and you'd get your physio, and they kind of went hand in hand. Now it just feels so disparate and, you know, not joined up. That's just, yeah.
Yeah. And the things that you experience throughout your kind of journey, you've always got something different that comes into play.
Yeah. And I suppose that brings us on nicely into starting like a family, because like talking about those, you know, acceptable outcomes and treatment goals and things like that, that changes, doesn't it, through your sort of, yeah, life journey with arthritis. How did that, this is quite a big question, but how did that play a part in, like, you know, if you're starting a family, and did it, was your treatment presumably affected? You've mentioned things like methotrexate and that. Do you want, yep, to tell us a little bit about how that worked out?
Yeah. So I remember when I got diagnosed, I went for my second appointment to start the medication. So I was 28, so kind of, I guess, prime fertile stage of my life. And the rheumatologist that I was seeing said, do you want a family? And I was like, I was with my husband. He wasn't my husband yet. And we both sort of looked at each other. We hadn't had this conversation. We'd just moved in with each other. So we were like, yes, but not now. So right, bang, you get methotrexate. And sort of told to keep sort of having those conversations. And at that point, obviously guidelines always change. You had to be off methotrexate for about 6 months before looking to start a family. So it was about, so my kind of main priority to begin with was sort of getting my disease under control and sort of feeling like I was in a, you know, a good position. Because also, you know, if you're feeling a bit fat, a bit, you can't move, you don't really want to have sex either. So there's all those kind of things that are, you know, part of that whole kind of, you know, helping the whole person. So it was about 3 years later. So I was about 31. I started having those conversations that we were thinking about starting a family. So I was very lucky because I had a really, really brilliant nurse at the time. Unfortunately, she's not in the department anymore, but she really, really helped me because at the time to start biologics, you had to be on methotrexate. So what she did was she put me, she did all the sort of funding, did all the tests to kind of get me through. So, and obviously your disease activity has to be a certain score at the time. That's thankfully for lots of patients now that's been lowered, but she just said to me, say ow a few more times when I touch your knuckles and then you'll qualify.
I know, I can relate to that as somebody who had to get that three or more active areas, and I didn't have inflamed joints. And
it depends on the day, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, totally does.
You know, it's so silly.
And when they do x-rays, which only show like damage rather than active, and I convinced them to send me for like an ultrasound, and I was crying when the guy says, oh, your hands look all right. And I cried. He asked me why I was crying. And I said, because I desperately need you to find something because I'm in so much pain. And he found it in two places, hadn't found it in the third. And he told me he'd only found it in the two, and then it magically all went through. So I don't know what happened there, but something, yeah. You know. And sometimes you need that person advocating for you who can see that you're in real difficulty, but you just don't tick all the boxes, do you?
Yeah. And so she got me onto my first biologic, and that biologic at the time, you could be pregnant up until sort of 32 weeks on it or something. But actually there's a story before that. I was doing something for NRAS and I was talking about all my problems, and my consultant at the time had actually been saying I couldn't be on a biologic. Or this might have been later. Timeline's gone a bit fuzzy.
Yeah, I know how that feels.
And luckily one of their like chief medical officers wrote a letter to my rheumatology team saying, actually, if you look at the research, this is what a patient is allowed in this situation. So a lot of this stuff I think comes down to kind of luck as well a little bit, as in who you've got in your team, who you know, and who can kind of help you at the time.
And as someone who's done a bit of traveling, meeting other people from other countries as well, like I used to moan a lot about those holes we had to jump through. But then when you see how many countries there are where they're not even available, it's like, it was such an eye opener for me last year. I can't even imagine existing without biologics today. So yeah, it's frustrating trying to get access.
Yeah, so biologics, basically, that's when, once I've been on biologics, I realised actually on the other drugs, I wasn't that well.
Yes.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
I thought I was a lot better and I thought I was doing really well. The nurses, the consultants told me I was. But when I went on biologics, I was like, oh, so there was like little nodules and things that kind of then kind of disappeared. And for me, they've been the best thing ever.
Yeah, exact same experience. I thought I was well managed on methotrexate, ruined my liver like it does for a lot of people, or got a little bit dangerous and had to come off it. And then you go on biologics, like you said, you suddenly, oh, okay, so this is, and again, it goes back to educating people, doesn't it? And letting people know what the, you know, kind of setting expectations and what, you know, because if you don't know, you don't need to ask and demand for more, do you, unfortunately?
And also at the time, I couldn't really, so when you're in the waiting room, sorry, I've gone completely off topic, but when you're in the waiting room, you don't see people that look like you.
Yes.
Generally, I mean, soon I'll be in this camp, but generally,
I'd say the same, yeah.
Generally, you see all silver surfers in the waiting room, and you feel a bit weird because you can. I always used to. It was probably just more me, but I felt like everybody was looking at me, like, "Why are you in this department?" Mm. And I quite often would get asked, like, I was a consultant or a, I don't know. People would say, "Oh, where's this?" And I was like, "I'm a patient, thanks."
Yeah, I used to get asked, "Were my parents in with a consultant?" Which is horrible. I'm sitting there, you know what I mean? Because their assumptions get made, don't they? But I would just go back to that bit you said about having a nurse that was championing you, because I'm the same. I had an amazing biologist nurse. She's disappeared now during pandemic and everything, and I think about her a lot. And because if it wasn't for her, I don't know about you, but like rheumatologists, for all of their expertise in that, they are terrible at that family planning conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a male and it wasn't as serious for me. I'd still have to stop my methotrexate, but I had no issues with biologics. Turned out sulfasalazine was stopping us starting a family. But those conversations, they're so dry and poorly delivered. And if it wasn't for my biologics nurse, I wouldn't have felt like anyone understood the impact that my disease and my treatment was having on starting a family. And again, going back to what we were saying earlier, that really worries me that issue with access to those at the moment and that personalized sort of like they know you, don't they? I don't know. It just worries me. How do you think in the old model before nurses and everything, when it was just the rheumatology, I can't even imagine.
I think that would be awful. And right now the difficulty is, so I used to have I had a really good actual rheumatologist that she probably looked after me for my first 3 years. And then when I went down the sort of biologics route, then my biologics nurse was brilliant. So those two, I had a really positive first sort of 3 to 4 years from diagnosis, because I had two people that knew me really, really well. But since then, so the last sort of nine years, basically every time I go, I've got a different, whether it's a different nurse, a different rheumatologist. I sometimes don't know if I'm seeing the nurse or the rheumatologist. So you just don't have any rapport. They don't know who I am. And then you're going through half of the appointment is talking about the things that you've talked about a million times before, and you kind of get a bit bored of yourself. I don't know if you find that. You kind of like, I've said this so many times.
And you've clearly only read the first page on the note.
Yes.
let's be honest. But yeah, it bothers me, because the bit that bothers me, maybe like wearing my advocate hat on, which maybe isn't so obvious to any sort of just patients watching this, is that like we know in England, NHS England, everything, that patient initiated follow-up thing is coming, you know, but it annoys me that it feels like that's already started, you know, that lack of personalization, that who shouts the loudest will get brought back into the system. You know, we shouldn't be moving away from that regular appointment, regular checkup, designated biologic nurse model yet. But in my experience, that's already long. Yeah, it's gone already. And it was so ironic that I got an email today asking to fill out a survey about patient initiated follow-up. So I'm thinking, practically doing this already. I'm already out of the door as an old hat, you know, treated and diagnosed arthritis patient. And
sometimes you don't know yourself, maybe, if you're having issues. And I'll hold my hand up. I'm not very good at remembering to go for my blood tests. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not going for blood tests and I'm not getting follow-ups, then they don't know how I'm doing.
No. And mine's a perfect example of that, in that, you know, I was recently neutropenic and my last blood test was in January, but I'd gone to the doctors 3 or 4 times for antibiotics for infections, And nobody thought to do a blood test earlier. And it's that sort of stuff that just really bothers. I know I'm going way off topic here, Kate.
No, it's fine. I always like to think about Doris that lives in the village.
Yeah.
That just doesn't think about this. Yeah. Sorry if anybody's called Doris watching. who just doesn't think about any of this stuff.
And isn't educated.
Yeah.
Yeah, it shouldn't be down to us. And the trouble is, we haven't addressed the educating the patient issue now. So how we're ready to go down a patient-initiated follow-up pathway when patients don't know when to ask for help. And also, there's some like me, I'm a hypocrite when I talk about my advocacy because I'm terrible for asking for help. You know, the amount of people that will be on my Twitter feed or whatever telling me, oh, Joel, you've got to ring this person, you've got to do that. And I'll tell other people to do it, but I haven't always got the energy or the fight in me to do it myself, or I worry about bothering people when there's worse off and this sort of thing. So I think, if we haven't got the educated, informed patient bit sorted yet, why we're just leaving people out? Anyway, we've gone way off subject, Katie, but it's nice to know somebody else.
I could rant about this sort of thing all day.
yeah. So because like I say, you're jumping from one thing to another. You need to do the work in the middle first. That's my takeaway. But it's nice to know you had that biologic nurse experience. And again, it goes back to the earlier point that we said, where if you're a new patient tomorrow, it just bothers me, and I'd like to do more about that, and I don't know how. So if anyone's watching this who knows how I could help make more noise about that, then please get involved. So if we fast forward a little bit, so you, I'm assuming everything went well, we're starting a family and your little one and everything, and then how did you adjust to that period? Did it cause more problems for your arthritis? How was your disease during them early years?
So not brilliant, because at the time I had to come off biologics. I was really, really lucky that, I know many people will experience this, but not everybody, that pregnancy, my RA kind of went away. But whether it was the pregnancy, whether it was the fact I was on biologics for the most of my pregnancy, I don't know. But 32 weeks pregnant, had to come off biologics. I took sulfasalazine, I think, all the way through from memory. Mm-hmm. But then what you find is it comes back with a vengeance. But mine was actually similar to when it first sort of came on, because it was kind of quite a gradual sort of onset of, I suffer predominantly in my sort of hands, wrists, ankles and feet. But the issue you've got with being a new parent is all the equipment is not friendly to really painful wrists, or you know, everything's like heavy. We tried to combat that by looking at kind of light prams, but I don't think there's really a light pram. If I was going to have a baby now, I'd probably buy a yo-yo. So that, you know, it's just having that understanding of what equipment is there. I was thankful actually that I breastfed for quite a long time, because that really sort of helped. Some people will struggle with some of the positions, but you're not having to faff with sort of bottles. So it's, you know, working out whatever works best for you, essentially. But no, it was horrible. And I knew, I'd done a bit of research, and I knew there was a biologic that you can take throughout pregnancy, throughout breastfeeding. So because I was breastfeeding, I couldn't go back onto my biologic. We'd made a plan that I'd only breastfeed for 6 months so I could go back on it. But my son had very different ideas about that and didn't like a bottle. So I did a bit of research. I sort of advocated for myself, got an appointment with the head rheumatologist at my hospital. He was horrible. And he just said, well, why should we bother? You're just going to have another baby. And I was like, well, this, and you know, you're quite, you know, my son was about 9 months. You're quite hormonal. Yeah. You know, you're still,
you're not sleeping,
on no sleep, not in a good place in any capacity. Joints hurt, can't pick up anything. Like, go and see somebody who you think might have a solution, because you've done a bit of your own research. And he just said, nah, you can't. Not going to do that for you. So
you're triggering a lot of my little bugbears, Katie, tonight, experiences.
So I'd been going and having like a load of steroid injections. Like, I was constantly going for a steroid injection because everything was just not happy. And it's like, why am I like, you should have given me this drug in the first place, in my opinion. Yeah. But it's obviously not a drug that, you know, your department sign up to, or, you know, you've probably not got a great, you know, you might not go to golf with your pharmaceutical company selling it. I don't know. I'm digressing. But eventually, I don't know what I did. So people would probably want to know what I did, but I can't remember. I think I just kept on calling, emailing, and being quite annoying until they gave me that biologic. So persistence was definitely key. And a lot of post-pregnant female tired hormones, and just cried at this, like, this 60-year-old man until he'd give me the medication that I wanted. But I know a lot of people would go, they'd be told no, and then they'd just go home and be in loads and loads of pain. So it just, I found it the most, this is actually the most frustrated I was ever in the whole time. Because they were just saying, well, tell your son not to breastfeed. And I was like, well.
And it goes back to that being that unrelatable thing again, doesn't it? You talked about the waiting room, and then you've got a 60-year-old man trying to, you know, give you terrible parental advice. And
yes,
really,
yeah.
You want solutions, not just things are going to just cause you more heartache. Yeah. So, yeah, that's just, yeah, just horrendous. Sorry, I'm sorry you had that. No, I'm sorry you had that experience. You're just fueling me now. So you just get campaigning.
So that's something I would like to see. So really, when a female and men, if you're in an age range where you might want to have children, I think from the off, where it's possible, they should be putting you onto sort of medications. That means your medication is not going to be interrupted, because, you know, there's new things, new research coming out all the time. So things change sort of rapidly. So I don't think there's any reason for people to suffer.
No. And also, it's like, what it bothers me when people get given methotrexate or whatever, because there's also such a big stigma around that. And you only have to spend 10 minutes on Instagram to see people just want to race to biologics because of, they don't understand, like, people like me and you, methotrexate worked really well, and it worked really well for me for a lot of years. It didn't end great, but there's also downsides to biologics and everything else. And I think the trouble is, when you're giving people something strong like this, and then you're also in the same breath saying about, don't start a family, or don't do this, I don't know, it's just, you could package that so much better than I feel that they do, and it doesn't help themselves. And then if people don't understand the risks, don't understand what you're trying to achieve with the drug, then of course they're not going to stick with it, and they're going to try and jump forward to other options. And
and it's like, sorry, something else. I was, as soon as I was diagnosed, I was put straight on the pill.
Yeah.
And it doesn't agree with me. The hormones have never, you know, I have to use other forms of contraception. And that again, I was just told, if you're going on methotrexate, you have to go on contraception. And there was no discussion. And because I guess you're kind of in that, I think as patients, especially when you're newly diagnosed, you feel like you're on the back foot. So you will do kind of what you're told, if you've got my sort of personality. Until I sort of was more educated, I never said anything back. So it's just that delivery and making sure people understand, it's getting the healthcare system to understand people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it really does. As somebody who's been on receiving end a lot of those conversations, yeah, that human. And I think that's where the biologics nurses are so awesome, you know, that they, like, for me anyway, my experience was they understood me, they knew what I wanted to do, what was going on in my life and how it had changed and what my personal benchmarks were. And I feel like we lost that a lot since the pandemic, or in my personal experience.
Yeah. So I once said to my consultant, I want to be able to do a cartwheel again.
Yeah.
And they, I mean, you know, maybe I'm not bothered now, but when I was younger, I did. And they just laughed at me, and you know, it is sort of funny, but it was more about having the wrist strength than the arm strength.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just little things like that that kind of sometimes just get laughed at and pushed to one side. And that, because my consultant's comeback was, well, I can't do that. And I was like, well,
and there's also the other side of it. Like, I went for a phase where a doctor would always say to me, like, the opening gamble would always be, how's the rugby going, or how's the hockey going? And I hadn't been able to do it for ages, and I was heartbroken about it. And like, it almost like, you know, when your mate would say, they'd ask you to do something in the hope that that'd magically help you run it off or what. And it's kind of what that conversation felt like every time, like a parent saying to your, oh, is your homework done? Like when you know full well it isn't.
Yeah.
And just saying that, you're demoralizing me from minute one. And that, you know, we need to find a way of them, of building them bridges where people understand their patient more than what the test results say or more than what the treatment says. Oh, Kate, you've triggered me on so many. You've triggered me on so many things tonight. I feel like I'm going to sort of come off here and ring you up, and we're going to start a campaign on something to fix some of this. But I'm conscious of your time. So if we just fast forward a little bit, in that, how did you? So you know, those early years with kids is tough and everything. You've talked about how exercise has helped you and keep moving, and you obviously were really sporty before the arthritis and everything. How have you balanced that? Because I know it's something I've failed at numerous times on and off. How have you balanced living with a condition like arthritis, parent, and just having the energy and time to do it all?
I think it's really, really tricky. And I have to say, there's one good thing that's come out of COVID is for, I know not everybody can, but being able to work from home a lot more than previously has kind of given me an extra 2 hours a day, essentially. So I'd normally commute an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening. So that's where I think that's given me back a little bit of time, which is when I will try and do things for myself. So I jog, and I play for a local netball team, play quite badly for a local netball team, but still play for a local netball team just for more the sort of social aspect. So I'm quite a sort of sociable, outgoing person. So I do, you know, I quite like that sort of element of sport. But I think one of the things is I've always been sporty. So it's not like I suddenly decided to become sporty once I was diagnosed. I'd already been doing lots of different things. And it's sort of, the diagnosis made me more determined. So I'm not sure I'd still be doing as much sport if I didn't have the diagnosis. Because I think obviously life can get in, like work, kids, family, lots of things can kind of get in the way of your kind of time in that side. But I think because part of my body isn't that healthy, I want to try and kind of combat that as much as possible. Don't know if that really answers the question, but
I was gonna say, like, as somebody that's sort of like, you talked about, you know, almost being more motivated, or you know, your condition, you're sort of more determined. As somebody who's had their fair share of setbacks, where, like, you know, I tend to be a bit boom and bust. When I'm really well controlled, I do ridiculous sports I probably shouldn't be doing, and then I suffer and get really depressed and mentally affected when I can't, and I lose that social circle element. How do you keep pushing through that? I'd need to know that personally, because I've failed numerous times. But how do you sort of sustain that motivation when you have all the setbacks that our disease can present?
Yeah, so I've definitely done the sort of boom and bust thing. So as an example, I entered the London Marathon the year after I was diagnosed, and I was in the opening ceremony for the Olympics. That was just stupid. So I spent a lot of days crying, either running crying or at some stupid rehearsal crying, because I felt horrendous. So I think it's been a lot of trial and error in terms of doing too much. So it's really hard, because it's so personal to each person.
Yeah.
You've got to sort of work it out. So you've got to, I think you have got to make the mistakes of the boom and bust stuff to then figure out what works for you. So I have to make sure I have rest days where I pretty much do nothing, to sort of counterbalance. It's obviously like there's the spoon theory, and I think about it across a week rather than a day. So it's just building in that time. I think I'm very lucky, because I've got a very good husband who picks up a lot of like the childcare runs and, you know, all the different things as well. So it's just finding that balance and hopefully having that kind of support network around you that can just help when needed.
I think our support network is crucial, and we talk a lot about on here about how that can take many forms. I think when you say support network, people often think, well, just like immediately those around you in the house, but that could be anything, you know. And that's one of the reasons why we create the peer support spaces we do for people that maybe need that extra from people that maybe don't understand who are around them. Yeah. But yeah, I think they're really good points there. And another way someone explained it to me is that sort of like flattening the curve, because we're like a boom and bust. You can, you feel good. So you can go and get a load of stuff done today, but that feeling good will only last for a day. Or you can sort of dilute those activities and maybe make that good period last 3 or 4 days. Yeah. I still fail at it occasionally, but I try and remind myself. But and I suppose you adapted as well, didn't you? Like, you know, if your hands and wrists, feet are affected, then maybe netball is a bit easier than tennis.
So I can't play tennis anymore. It's too painful. So that decision was made for me. I battled attempting to play for a good 2 or 3 years, and also I used to do a lot of dancing, but again, you don't wear supportive shoes. So I did a lot of sort of jazz type stuff. So it'd be mainly kind of barefoot, and the amount of times my feet would just be crunching, and like age, I probably wouldn't have been dancing anyway because of age. But you just have to adapt and find the activities that work for you, essentially.
Yeah, and it hurts emotionally. Like I it's okay to talk about it, like, for people, anyone watching this, like I talk about it a lot as being like a grief cycle, and it is, you know, when them decisions are made for you, you know, there's something about being able to quit something on your own terms, and then when you can't have the choice. Like, I know full well, you know, I'm fast approaching 40, I probably wouldn't still be playing rugby now, but I'd still like to have decided when I couldn't play, and there's that element of it. So it's good that you've replaced it. I feel like I've replaced mine with advocacy. I still need to try and like get back out to being sporty, because I'm like you, a very sporty person. But do you find, like, for me, what holds me back a lot is benchmarking? Like, I'm conscious that if I go to the gym tomorrow, I'm going to remember what I used to be able to lift compared to what I could do now, et cetera, et cetera.
So I do that all the time. So even just my 5K running time, I still know what I could do before, and I'm way, 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 way off it. And something I would say I absolutely love is park run. Because, and now it's not just about running either. It's about, so I'll quite often volunteer and be like the tail walker, or I'll be the run 1 minute, walk 1 minute volunteer. So they've got, it's kind of a real nice sort of way of bringing people together to exercise, but it's not about kind of performance. It's more about just being there and doing it. So that's one thing I would say, if people have got one locally, it's a brilliant sort of, you know, you've got people out with their dogs, people pushing their kids in prams, that sort of thing I think is great. If you like running or walking, not everybody does.
I used to love running just for the headspace. I found for me it was just, it gave me time to process stuff, and I don't get that space now. And I'm sure my long-suffering wife notices that as well, because like you say, you work from home, don't you? You work from home and you go downstairs in my case, and you're straight with your family hat on, and not having that sort of, like, I think that's where I have the biggest miss from not doing the exercises, the mental side of it.
Yes. Yeah, no, and running for me is very much, I've never been able to meditate, but I think running for me is a bit like meditation, because I completely don't think about anything.
Or worry about making sure you get home.
I'd always
make sure that I went a little bit further than I was comfortable with, because it'd give me something to focus on.
Well, no, so when I did my first marathon, there was many times when I was calling my husband saying, can you pick me up? I can't get home. Everything hurts.
Yeah, I've had my fair shares of being collected. Mine was when I was cycling. I'd go out and stupidly think I could cycle 60 miles or something without any real prep. And my wife would have to bring out lots of sugar and supplies. I'd sit on the side of the road for half an hour and then sort of bumble back. But I don't think we'll ever get rid of that. So I think for anyone, like, and I was diagnosed really young, but I think for anyone that has had a previous life prior, I think, and like you get good remission periods. You know, I had a few in my 20s and 30s where they were real, like, I basically felt normal, for one, for a better word. And then it is hard not to compare to that, isn't it? And benchmark. And
no, definitely. Yeah.
You go too hard on it. So, it's a cycle of grief, guys. And you're not alone if you feel that way occasionally. But it's nice to hear people that are, that are still doing positive things for me. And you're certainly inspiring me to get off my backside more, because I think there has definitely been times, I don't know about you, where I've used my disease almost as like that excuse, because I'm fearful of how much it's going to hurt or what the repercussions are going to be like. It's easier sometimes to, I don't know, go into ostrich mode and not try anything rather than try something just at a lower level or a lower impact.
Yeah, so I really, really struggled when I was first diagnosed. So I did used to go to the gym quite a lot. I don't really do that now because time problems, but I'd go to a lot of classes and I felt really, really embarrassed at the start of a class saying, I can't do that because of my wrists. So I'd try and do things that I shouldn't be doing. So it's really hard, because I didn't want to tell a teacher that I'd got arthritis, because inevitably someone will go, oh yeah, my granny, she's got problems with her wrist.
Oh, I thought only old people got that. That's a classic one. But I think that's that disability adjustment, isn't it? And once you start accepting it, then suddenly asking for help gets a lot easier as well. And I'm still going through that cycle, but I know lots of people who tell me that, who are out the other side of that sort of journey, finds it a lot easier to then ask for accommodations that maybe you wouldn't have done before.
I think age helps.
Definitely. And I think when I was in my 20s, I could push through and suffer the consequences a bit more. Now I can't, and I've got little people that depend on me, as you do, and I think that comes into the thinking as well, doesn't it?
I'm
conscious to ask you quickly before you go, as we sort of we're sort of, this time's flown by, Kate. I feel like we could talk about lots of subjects tonight and still be until midnight. I want to ask you a little bit about what got you into sort of volunteering. Obviously, you do lots of awesome stuff for NRAS, for anyone who isn't aware, it's arthritis charity here in the UK. What got you into that? And then maybe tell us a little bit about what you do for NRAS.
So I can't honestly remember, but I do remember sort of doing a sort of, they were asking for people to help with their first RA Awareness Week. I think that was maybe in like 2013 or something. So I sort of volunteered for that, had no idea what I was doing, had no clue about the charity. And then it sort of evolved from there. I think I kind of wanted to find more people that I could relate to, which is always a struggle, but I'll get onto that in a minute. But in terms of sort of volunteering, it kind of evolved from kind of helping out with different kind of, whether it was videos, speaking at events, sort of telling my story, and then I sort of helped out with they've got a peer-to-peer support line, so anyone that's newly diagnosed that wants to talk to somebody that's been through something similar to them. So I quite often will sort of speak to sort of people of a similar age, or people diagnosed at a similar age, people looking to start a family, or people that want to get back into sort of exercise. So I do those sort of on and off. And then I volunteered. They were setting up a face-to-face support group. So I live sort of South London. So the closest one is Croydon. So I became one of their group leaders for the Croydon area. So anyone in the Croydon area, big potential, come along to some of the meetings. We have kind of like different people speaking, very haphazardly happen now because I'm the only volunteer running it. And then in lockdown, I tried to transfer those meetings to sort of Zoom, but the general audience that attend didn't really like sort of digital interaction. So then I worked with NRAS to set up, we've set up the Join Together digital groups. The one I'm most involved with is Exercise and Back to Sports. We have lots of different sort of speakers, from sort of physios to fatigue lecturers, all different people, to try and the idea is to try and inspire people back into exercise or sport, or for those that are already participating to kind of talk around the challenges that they face and how they get over them. So similar to what we've spoken about today. And then we've also got one for parenting, people that have inflammatory arthritis and are a parent, and equally for parents of children with JIA and sort of similar conditions. And then there's also one for people working. So quite busy. But I'd say it was
funny how you fall into this whole thing.
Yeah. And then it was sort of in lockdown. I got furloughed, obviously, also was completely forgotten the word, where we all had to stay inside because of our condition.
Oh, Shielden.
Yeah, that's the one. I kind of turned to social media, and it's amazing. I didn't know. So shielding essentially kind of, I kind of didn't realise, I guess, how serious the drugs and things were that we're all on. And I knew that a lot of the drugs would sort of inhibit your immune system, but for me, I've never really had too many problems in that area. So I was just quite shocked, to be honest, that I was in a higher severity category to my mum. So you know, who knew? I actually am 96. So yeah, I don't know what the question was, but I've gone off on a complete tangent.
That's absolutely fine. I think that is that, like, that bringing people together, there is so much to be said for that. Like, I was somebody that I went most of my life not talking about my arthritis. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I didn't want to be judged my sport and ability based on that, or you know, the whole you did well considering kind of thing. And then, like you say, that lockdown happened, and suddenly people felt comfortable sharing that stuff because it became a topic, and it almost became a group people weren't ashamed to be part of. And around the same time, I'd started talking about my experiences. And yeah, it was really powerful, wasn't it? I know we didn't sustain that, and lots of people have since gone back to the place where I was, and I respect that because I was there. But I think the conversations we did have, and what has then gone on to continue, like the work that you're doing, the stuff that we're doing here, it felt really special out of a really difficult time for people, didn't it?
Yeah, it really changed my mindset, and it did make me realise how many people were in similar sort of stages in their life to me. Because my son was like 2 at the time. So it was really hard, to be honest, shielding with a 2-year-old. And I didn't totally shield. We did go out for like 1 family walk a week, and I did 1 run a week. Yeah. Otherwise, I would have really, really struggled. So I think you just had to find ways for you to kind of cope depending on, I guess, your own, you know, situation and circumstances.
Yeah, no. So is there anything you want, because you obviously do the exercise activity, where can people find that if they've listened to you tonight and felt inspired and motivated? Where can people find that or more information on that?
So if you go to the NRAS website and look up their Join Together groups, you'll find the email address. So actually the easiest way is I am joinedtogether@nras.org.uk, and then I can direct people if they wanted to attend any of those groups. And the exercise and back to sport group, we've got our next meeting on Zoom on the 18th of May. So if anyone's interested, just email me and I can send a registration link. And we're having a talk from a gentleman at Keyactiv, which is basically like a bit of a sort of exercise social prescribing organisation. So that should be quite interesting, because I keep hearing a lot about social prescribing, but I don't really know what it is.
I didn't discover it until 2 years ago, and it's absolutely blown my mind and changed. Massive.
Yeah, so I'm quite I'm really intrigued by it. So actually, if you have any talks on here around it, I
haven't been able to get anyone on to come and share their only my personal, but yeah, like when I didn't realize there was things like, you know, employment support and, you know, getting active and all these sort of things, and mine will come up from shielding. You know, I didn't realize these people were available that could get you access to stuff, and it's basically thinking outside that treatment, you know, bubble.
I think we're all so medicated.
Hot topic at the minute. Yeah.
But it's kind of like there's other methods of medication, but they don't come through all the time.
Yeah, it's like you say, that well-being, mental health support, the talking therapies, the employment services, the financial services. It's amazing. And I found pain
talking
management
therapies is brilliant. We've had them talk at our Croydon group. Yeah. Loads. So they're always they're my go-to when I can't find anybody.
That's it. And I've self-referred for CBT three summers in a row since the pandemic, and that is purely because every summer I see a load of Facebook pictures of my mates getting back together for pre-season. It properly rocks me, and that now I know it's going to come, I actually prepare for it. But I would have had no idea how to access any of that if it wasn't for social prescribing. So again, anyone watching this that wants to come on, who's got experience of delivering those sort of services, that'd be awesome, because there are so many people here in the UK that don't know any of those services exist, and they're an absolute gold mine for helping people outside the box. I think that's probably the holistic sort of approach. Right, I feel like we should wrap this up, Katie, because
I didn't notice the time.
No, you're fine. I'm worried more about you. You're the guest here. But like I always say, these conversations should be like a coffee shop discussion, and I've never felt one more so than tonight. Like I feel like we could have just gone off on 101 tangents. We clearly got lots of similar experiences and views and everything. So I will put anyone who's watching this back or listening to this back, I'll put any links to what Katie's mentioned tonight in the show notes. Do you want to just give a quick mention where people can find you on social media, Katie?
Very good point. So I'm at joint.adventure on on Instagram. There you go, I am 96. And on Twitter, I'm very simple, Katie Pieris, and LinkedIn, pretty much the same.
Someone has actually said in chat, Katie is actually Doris.
I know, I saw that. Oh, you deserve I started chuckling to myself. I'm actually talking about myself when I talk about Thomas.
Yeah. I say I do worry when we talk about our arthritis experiences, because I am very quickly becoming that sort of middle-aged person I didn't relate to. So I have to remember that in my messaging as well. Thank you so much for sharing your experience tonight, Kate. More importantly, thank you so much for coming in on a different evening after my sort of absence delayed the talk. Really do appreciate it. And like I say, I've never felt like I've known someone more without actually speaking to them. So if that doesn't tell you about the magic of what happened over that pandemic period on social media, nothing will, I think. So thank you for joining me. It's great to get to know you properly.
Thank you very much. No, brilliant.
All right, enjoy the rest of your evening, Katie. And thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.